Welcome to a special edition of Path to Zero, recorded from the Reuters Global Energy Transition Summit in New York City. Now, here's your host, Tucker Perkins.
When it comes to producing carbon-free electricity, long-duration energy storage may be the most important factor. In this episode, we have the opportunity to talk to the co-founder and CEO of an energy storage company that says it has the answer to the challenge of relying on renewable energy when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow. We're pleased to welcome Curtis Van Wallingham, CEO of HydroStore. Curtis, welcome to Path to Zero. It's great to have you today.
Excellent. Glad to be here, Tucker.
We're going to talk about a lot of things over the next 30 minutes, but why don't we just start with HydroStore and kind of what it is and what you do and maybe how you fit in with that. Talk to us about that.
Sure. So HydroStore, we're a long-duration energy storage provider. So we invented a new way of using compressed air to store electricity. You know, the wind doesn't always blow, sun doesn't always shine. So storing that up, batteries are great for it. We give an alternative, which is compressed air. And the way we do it is we essentially mine out a cavern 2,000 feet underground, fill it with water, and then we push air down to lift the water up and hold it as potential energy. And then when the grid needs power, open a valve, the air comes out, spins a turbine, and goes back to the atmosphere. So we're the technology provider. We've patented that. But we're also a developer. So we develop the projects, get the offtake permits, project finance them, and help enable the energy transition.
Why would anybody be against that? I mean, you're talking about relatively inert, everyday components, mining, CO or compressed air, and water.
Yeah, it is a closed loop. It's very compact. Use about 1/20th the water of pumped hydro for the same capacity. And what we found is it really doesn't have much permitting opposition. We can go in even into arid deserts, and we produce water when we run, because when you compress air, it knocks the moisture out, which is more than you lose through evaporation. So we found really strong community and environmental organizational support behind the technology. The biggest barrier has been the revenue pathway and paying for long duration storage on the grid. You really don't need it until you get a certain amount of wind and solar on your grid, and then it becomes a reliability play, and utilities are reluctant to pay for it until it's clear they need it.
I want to talk a lot about your technology, but let's go up a level and think about maybe competing ways we store energy, because so many different ways we're thinking about batteries for long duration energy storage. You know, Tesla's got a view, there's rusting batteries now. Talk about how you fit in. Maybe talk about the whole landscape of batteries and battery technology, and then how you fit in.
Certainly. So the tried and true, well-established technologies are really pumped hydro, pumping water up a hill and treating it like a hydroelectric dam. The challenge with them is they're very limited sites. They're hard to permit. They use a lot of water. And so they're a big contributor today. There will be more of them, but I think there's limits on how many more because of the siting and the permitting challenges. Then you've got lithium ion batteries. They've done a fantastic job as the EV market's grown. Their costs have come down. They really are the dominant technology for 4 hours and less. And they may have a role up to 6-7 hours even. But as you grow in duration, their costs scale linearly. And they don't last very long. They degrade. They've got recycling challenges. And so where compressed air fits in is we're bankable and proven. We are easier to permit than pumped hydro, easier to site than pumped hydro, and we are just cheaper than batteries when you get to 8 hour plus durations. To give you a sense, our marginal cost to add an hour is about $50 per kilowatt hour, and batteries are on a fully installed basis around $300. And then we last 50 years, and they're lasting 10 to 15 years with degradation. So pretty stark difference. I think our math shows at 8 hours, we're about 30% lower cost on a fully blended sort of basis. You then mentioned all the upcoming technologies, and there are a lot of them, be it flow batteries, sodium ion, iron air, then there's different gravity solutions being explored. Thermal is a big player, where you just take renewable energy, make heat, and then turn that heat back into electricity. A lot of those are still in the development phase. We don't really know their full performance characteristics because they haven't been deployed at scale yet. So for the sake of the climate and the energy transition, really hope a number of those are compelling. It's not going to be a silver bullet, you know, one solution wins it all. But right now it's really lithium ion, pumped hydro, and compressed air as the kind of bankable, proven solutions ready today.
Yeah, thanks for that. That's a great kind of a primer on where we are, because I think battery technology is just moving so fast. And I'm quick to say with certainty that the batteries of the future aren't even in the labs today. For you to be successful, are you looking for a certain type of geology? You mentioned you mine, so you must be thinking about having to use hard rock. Is that right?
That's right. So we can use a lot of different types of geology, a lot of different types of rock. Our estimates are about 40%, 50% of landmass works well for us. So it is pretty widely deployable. If you want to serve a market like New York, you know, we profile the geology over the transmission system, and about half of the substations we can locate near. So we can't go everywhere like a battery, but you know, pumped hydro is very rare to even find one substation you can go near. So for us, we bring a lot more siting flexibility than pumped hydro, but it is somewhat geology dependent, as you mentioned.
And sorry to get geeky technology on you for a second. The pressures inside this well, what kind of pressures are we talking about?
So we go down 2,000 feet or 600 meters. And because we use the air to lift the water, the pressure is set by the head up to the surface. So that 600 meters is about 60 bar of pressure. You know, to geek out a little bit, when you're down 600 meters underground, the pressure there is at 60 bar. The groundwater is trying to come in. The earth is trying to close that hole. So we're merely just propping it up. So the air is not really trying to escape, because the hole's trying to close. We're propping it open, and it's almost in its natural pressure state down there.
Such a simple but elegant solution. How long has this technology been around? Who's using it in other parts of the world?
Sure. So compressed air has been around about 50 years. There's a 100 megawatt plant in Alabama, 300 megawatt in Germany, been running 40, 50 years. But they had real issues with the technology. One, they burnt natural gas as part of the process. And two, they would only site them where there were salt caverns that are, frankly, just as rare as pumped hydro sites. So what HydroStore did 15 years ago, I met my co-founder. I was working at a utility that needed storage, was trying to build pumped hydro, couldn't find a site. And I met this gentleman from the oil and gas industry that said, hey, with these two innovations to compressed air, we could make it far more deployable and lower cost. And that was a thermal management system that would eliminate the need to burn natural gas. And secondly, this hard rock cavern flooded with water that could then be sited very flexibly. So we patented that, started the business in 2010, and almost 15 years now we've been working through it, building pilot plants, getting performance insurance, building small reference facilities. We then staffed up an independent power producer function to develop projects using this technology. And now we've got a 200 megawatt project in Australia. The off-takers include the largest transmission company there, Transgrid, as well as the state of New South Wales through AMO Services, and some energy retailers. And then in California, we've announced a PPA with one of the community choice aggregators for a 500 megawatt, 8-hour project we're building in Kern County, just outside of LA. Now we have 15 other 500 megawatt projects across North America, Australia, and we're starting to look at the UK and Western Europe as well. So the time is right for long duration storage. The mechanisms to pay for it are starting to be implemented. And so we're rapidly rolling this out globally one day.
So in a 100 megawatt system and then a 500 megawatt system, is there still just one well, or there are multiple wells?
So there's one cavern. It could be segmented into multiple caverns, but we typically would do one. But the compressors and the turbines, we get in roughly 100 or 125 megawatt train sizes. So a 500 megawatt would have 425 megawatt compressors. That way you could be doing maintenance on one or two and just keep rotating through. But the cavern, yeah, you could segment it if you wanted. There's not really a benefit of doing that. An interesting fact about the technology is if you say you built an 8-hour system, but 5-10 years down the road, you actually realize you need 15 or 20 hours. We can go down, build a second cavern next to it, connect the two together at the surface. And so with a very limited lead time, we can keep adding duration for a low marginal cost.
So the benefits are pretty obvious. Using conventional materials, conventional technology, you can deploy a really nice energy storage system that will pair nicely with solar and wind, right? What's the downside? Why hasn't this become the standard?
So you're right. We just use air, rock, water, proven supply chains, proven equipment. All of our workforce comes from the oil and gas sector. So we're helping to transition those jobs. So I think it is a really good story. The limitations thus far have more been on the policy regulatory side. So paying for essentially reliability isn't something the grid operators want to do. So short duration batteries have really taken off because they're just doing arbitrage and they got a short payback period. All the signals are there in the market. What 8-hour storage and longer does is it does those things, but it also gives you reliability. That one time every year, every second year, where you have a big duration without any solar and wind. And when those make up a big portion of your grid, you can now have brownouts or rolling brownouts without storage. So it's like an insurance policy, and it enables you to build more wind and solar. There haven't been the mechanisms to pay for it in the past. California started with an 8-hour mandate and an 8-hour resource adequacy product. Australia then came out with an 8-hour product. Now the UK came out, Ontario, New York just announced a carve out of up to 1.2 gigawatts of long duration storage just last week. So it is spreading. It's spreading rapidly. PJM has suggested this is what they need. The European Union suggested it. India has come out with policies. So it is now spreading. That's the signal we need to start investing in our development sites. So we're now backed by Goldman Sachs and the Canadian Pension Plan. We're scaling pretty rapidly and developing these projects. I think the second thing is similar to all other wind and solar and electricity companies, grid reform. How do you get queue positions? That's been really clogged up for a while. And then permitting, it just takes forever to permit anything, no matter how benign. So speeding up queue reform, speeding up permitting would also allow us to go faster. But the major bottleneck we've had was around the policy, but that seems to be ironing itself out now.
But if you think about things that people would oppose, I don't want that in my backyard. One, I would assume that's a fairly small footprint above the surface, fairly quiet.
Yeah, it is quite weak in noise. The compressors do make noise, but we put them in a building, an enclosure with all the noise attenuation, so we do bring the noise down quite a bit. So it's a small hum. I think if you're a few hundred meters away, it's more like an air conditioner type sound that you would hear. It is very compact. A 5-gigawatt-hour project fits on about an 80-acre plot of land. So that's the aerial footprint, the cavern underneath it, and the land up top for the plant and the surface reservoir. And we've had, you know, we got great support in California for our project. Very tough place to permit. We've permitted two in Canada. In Australia, we were the only project in New South Wales that had gone through a development process and had less than 50 inquirers or people engaging in the process, and in fact we only had 4. So it was the first time in years they've ever seen that few of people. So there are very little objections to the technology, and that's clearly a supporter for us, because lithium ion batteries with their potential for fire is causing quite a bit of concern, and pumped hydro with their water use and land use is also a concern. So permitting is definitely an advantage for us.
Yeah, and as you said, one of the things you need, you really need some kind of a rule that really is incentivizing that 8-hour storage, right? forces a utility to think beyond really short duration storage, meaning minutes or hours. But once you get that, you can move forward.
We can move forward. And the data centers and the tech companies are starting to push this now, right? With all the AI and load growth that's coming from data centers and artificial intelligence, they want green power 24/7. So they're kind of pressuring the utility, saying, well, how are you going to give me 24/7 green power? And the utility's answer is, I got to pay for storage. And if the data centers are willing to pay a bit of a premium to speed that up, then the utility can run the RFPs and pay for it by purchasing long duration storage.
And we rarely talk sometimes about all the inputs. Are you fairly efficient with your use of water? Do you waste a lot of water, need a lot of fresh water?
No, in fact, our one-time fill is very, very modest. It is, like I say, about 1/20th that of a pumped hydro plant. And then once we've done our one-time fill, we produce water on an ongoing basis. So every time we cycle and you compress air, you knock out the moisture in the air, which is more than we lose through evaporation, even in a desert. So we actually have to give away fresh, clean water over our 50-100-year operating life. And like I say, it's just that one-time draw, which we pay full top municipal rates to do, and we can be selective of when we do it, you know, trickle it in over a longer period of time if needed.
So you think a plant once built could have an economic life of 50 years, you said 100 years.
Yeah, it really is like hydro. These are perpetual assets. You got to keep, you know, overhauling your compressor and changing the bearings and stuff, but the hole in the rock isn't going anywhere. As I mentioned, we keep producing the water. So you keep just modifying the equipment, and you know, there's hydro plants that have been running 100 plus years, and it's very much the same with what we're doing.
And so now I'm going to talk a little bit about your background, because I know your background is interesting. We're going to get to that, but kind of tease up the question. How do you think about this technology? And because you have the initial cost, the operating cost, but clearly there's a benefit to that. How do you think about this technology over a span as long as a century? How do you price that out?
So the way we do that is you typically will get a 25, 30-year initial contract. So what we do is we ensure that the capital cost to build the facility, we get, call it 70% debt, 30% we'll put in as the owner as project level equity. That 25-year contract essentially pays off the debt. So the debt goes down to zero and gives a modest return on the equity. And then you have a fully depreciated paid off asset that you then recontract for. And that's really where the equity makes their money, because now you have no debt and all that returns to the equity holder. And then you just keep recontracting it over its life. And you're right, the capital cost is really the name of the game. Once you built it, the operating costs are like 1% of the capital cost per year. So a very de minimis amount. And you, like I say, you get all this ongoing revenue from the contract, but also arbitrage, just buy low, sell high, and making money that way.
Really interesting. All right, let's talk about you. Great, great journey. I actually studied you, so I know a little bit about it. But talk about your career and kind of how it led to this, and what motivated you to take this job.
Certainly. So I was engineer MBA as a kind of a professional training, if you will, education. I then got into management consulting, but around capital projects and companies that were troubled. So I would work around the world, turning around companies, refineries, doing post-merger integration. So that was a great learning ground, just seeing all different industries and challenges, and being essentially a professional problem solver at the end of the day. Did that for about 10 years. Then I joined a nuclear and wind generator called Bruce Power. And there I was doing planning and budgeting for the organization. And it was there that I realized, because Ontario's got a really neat mix of run-of-river hydro that you can't turn down and nuclear that you can't turn down. And that makes up like 90% of our generation. So when we put on wind and solar, you would start to see the impacts of that intermittency pretty early on, kind of a canary in the coal mine. So I tried to build a pumped hydro plant to smooth out that variability, couldn't find any sites, But then I met this guy, Cam Lewis, my co-founder, and you know, my team said, hey, there's a guy in Toronto that's got this new energy storage technology. You should meet him. So I meet him and he said, I got an idea and a brand name and a patent and I don't know what to do. So I said, well, clearly this isn't right for me as Bruce Power to be buying this from you. But I was really intrigued because his concept was really, if pumped hydro is holding water up in air, what if you submerge air underwater and you get the buoyancy force? And the more math I did, I said, look, this is really compelling. So I just took the plunge. I quit my job. I drained my savings, started the company, and really was kind of naive about entrepreneurship at the time, and stubbed my toe around every corner. And, you know, we eventually raised seed money. Then it was venture capital funding and building pilot plants. And like I say, 14, 15 years later, it's nice to see we've survived all the pitfalls, but are now thriving.
Awesome. What a great journey. So you're here in New York and you're going to speak at Reuters. Let's hear what you're going to talk about.
You know, it's largely around the role of long duration energy storage. I think a lot of people understand why wind and solar is proliferating. They're low cost. But energy storage's role in firming that up and how we get more energy storage on the grid is really going to be a focus of the fireside chat this afternoon.
And as we think about the grid, let's go back, even talk about your time with Bruce as well. If we think about the grid, we do have a proliferation of solar and wind, but for that to really work without what I would say often two grids, the intermittent grid and the baseload grid, energy storage has to work. Do you think we could get to the point where energy storage provides all of the solution to balance the intermittency of solar and wind?
Yeah, you know, when I started HydroStore 15 years ago, there was all this talk about 15-minute flywheels and batteries, and it was mostly for frequency regulation. A couple years later, it was a one-hour peak shaving battery. Then it was 2 hours. Then it was four. And as the intermittent renewables keep increasing, the duration of storage keeps increasing. And now we're at the point you start getting 30, 40% intermittent renewables, you need eight-hour storage. As you start getting to 60, 70%, you're going to start needing 16, 20 hours of storage. I'm not too sure that 80% intermittent and above, that's when you really start needing either a hydrogen come in or some other solution that can run for weeks at a time.
Right.
We have a patent within our portfolio, which is to essentially turn our system into a hydrogen plant. It could also run on natural gas if there was no hydrogen available. But essentially what we do is we have a compressor that compresses the air. We have a turbine that turns the air back into electricity. If there's no air in our cavern, we can bring a fuel source like a hydrogen in, compress atmospheric air, heat it up with the hydrogen, and then send it through the turbine. So we can essentially offer this 8 hour to 20 hour energy storage plus a run forever hydrogen capability. Products like that can get us to 100% absolutely, but we can't get there with just 8 to 20 hour storage. We'll need something in that multi-day variety, which there are storage solutions. You mentioned Iron Air earlier that are focusing on that multi-day market. The thermal is also a really good fit there because thermal can be very cheap. It's just very inefficient and slow to respond. So that's probably a better fit for that multi-day market.
What are some of the thermal technologies? They're storing heat in different media, but do you see one media that tends to have promise?
You know, they all have some promise. You can store it in just bricks underground. Graphene, there's all different molten salts. People are doing a wide range of solutions. The taking electricity and putting it into heat cost effectively is really not that hard. The question is, how do you turn heat back into electricity? And if you use a steam cycle, it's just very inefficient and slow.
Right.
And that's kind of the proven simple way of doing it that most are doing. There are groups like Antora that are trying to essentially take so much heat that they shine it out onto almost like a solar panel, a PV type cell, and turn it back to electricity that way. Maybe that's cost effective. I'm not too sure. But like I say, we need all the solutions we can get. So really happy that people are pursuing all those avenues.
Yeah, whenever I'm evaluating a new technology, I often think about something very few people think about, which is all of the inputs, right? And one of the things that strikes me about your system is it's probably pretty efficient and really is not using a lot of inputs that aren't obvious. So congratulations for that.
Yeah, you know, we have Pacific Northwest Labs working on a paper about the environmental impact, which is all that, the concrete, the steel, everything that goes into building your system and operating it over its life. And what has the least impact from a resources standpoint? So we're excited to see those results. We think we're going to show very well there, but obviously it's an independent study being conducted. When we talk efficiency in the energy storage sector, it tends to mean electricity in, electricity out. What's that ratio? On that metric, we're reasonably efficient, but we're not quite as, like lithium ion can be about 85%, but they typically exclude all their auxiliary cooling loads with that number. Right. And once you include that in, that number comes down a fair bit. And obviously depends on the climate and how often you use it. Pumped hydro can be, you know, 75% efficient. Pretty good, but they've got a lot of water evaporation. They have to top up and some other things, but they can be pretty efficient. We're in the 65, you know, up to 70%. So it's okay. It's similar to flow batteries. A lot of the other solutions are much lower, like whether it's liquid air, pumped thermal, thermal in general. Some of them are as low as even hydrogen. It can be 25, 30%. Right. So there is a pretty big range from that electrical round trip efficiency standpoint. We're about middle of the pack, but cost and permitting advantages are our real big, big advantages from our perspective.
And interesting, I think the more we think about hydroelectric, the more, and really study it, the more we realize there may be some previously unknown GHG formations that we really didn't talk about from all the decaying material. Your system is so closed, again, you have none of that. And we can study it for a long time and we'll still see no real unintended greenhouse gas emissions from that. And very interesting.
Yeah, and the equipment we use has all been used for 40, 50 years in LNG and the natural gas industry. So yeah, nothing really new and exciting with ours. It's just a unique way of packaging it together.
All right, a little bit of fun, time for some fun. We're gonna hand you a magic wand. And with that magic wand, here are the rules. Use it one time for one thing in the next year, so lots of ones, that you think would have the biggest impact on climate change. How would you use that wand?
I would say a global, a UN-backed border adjustment tax based on carbon emission. So if people are producing products in their country and it's generated using energy from emissions, that gets adjusted at the borders and penalizes the countries for doing it. Like would have the biggest impact is it could be a bit of a race to the bottom, right? Where is coal cheap? Okay, I'm going to use a whole bunch of coal and adjust. Yeah. I mean, maybe that's a little unfair to the developing world that didn't have as big of an impact getting us into this mess. But we need some sort of penalty for people to put carbon up in the atmosphere and hurting the economies, I think, is probably the best way to do it.
Good use of your wand. You know, I think almost every scientist tends to agree that we ought to have some price on carbon. We ought to be able to quantify what that price is. I think where most of us go that aren't political is how do you keep that price out of the political sphere? And I don't really know anywhere in the world that that's happening right now. You're playing on a worldwide. I mean, does Australia think about carbon and taxing differently than California and any other place you're thinking about taking your technology?
Yeah, they all have their local nuances with it. But when it comes down to like housing affordability and keeping bread on the table, you know, it's a pretty easy boogeyman to tackle, right? Because carbon is it's a far off problem. It's an everyone problem. And if you are having trouble keeping bread on the table, you don't want, you know, you're not going to sacrifice that for some future nebulous carbon benefit. So it's an easy boogeyman to attack. And frankly, I do see it being attacked in most places. So it's on the industry to just make it cheaper. And that's what I'm seeing in Australia is it is just so much cheaper. Everybody supports it, and it is lowering the electricity bills and keeping the lights on. And it's getting broad support despite the housing crisis, because everyone knows it would just be worse if you didn't have it. But it's a tricky one. And once it enters the political sphere, yeah, it's pretty tough to put that back in a box.
Great. All right, next one might be a tough one for you. I don't know. You're Canadian, but you do have an office in Denver, so we're going to work through that. We like to plant a tree in honor of the time you spent with us, the expertise you share with us. We like to plant it in the national forest, but we'll give you a little latitude. Where would you like to see that tree planted?
You know, we're building a project in the Australian outback in a town called Broken Hill, where they film the Mad Max movies, so you get a sense of what it looks like there. I would love to see a nice big tree outside of Broken Hill. Then I was also thinking of my hometown up near Kenora, but there's trees absolutely everywhere there. So I'd probably go focus in on a region that was recently hit by forest fires. So whether that's all across California or up near Alberta in Canada, where we've lost some magnificent forests from forest fires recently. So maybe throw a seedling in there to help help the regenerative process kick off.
Well, I appreciate you giving us three choices, and I hear them very clear. Let's first think about Australia, then let's think about Canada, and then if we have to, we can find a great forest in California. So that's great. I know producer Russ will look forward to working on that Mad Max location. He'll find some fun with that. Thank you a lot. Anything else you want to kind of tell our listeners? Certainly, I'd like you to tell us how to learn more about HydroStore and how they can stay in touch with you.
Certainly. So HydroStore, HYDROSTOR.ca, our website if you're looking for videos of how our technology works or to contact the team. I would say for the utilities out there, we're open for business. Whether we come in and build it, or if you want to rate base it and own it, we're happy to license the technology and connect you with the construction partners for you to own it using our intellectual property. And then just the general industry writ large, the Long Duration Energy Storage Council, LDES Council, is doing great work pushing that policy that we talked about at the onset of getting that revenue pathway to pay for storage before it's too late. And if we wait too long, everyone's going to keep sliding back to let's just build more gas plants to firm up the renewables. And there's a better way, and that's through energy storage and long duration storage. So really appreciate you having me and helping to amplify the voice of HydroStore and our 150 plus people working hard to drive the path to net zero.
Well, Curtis, what a wonderful journey, you personally and professionally. We look forward to learning more and studying more. And thank you for being here in New York. I look forward to your talk later today. And I look forward to learning more and being friends with you for a long time.
Excellent. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to a special edition of Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to pathtozero@propane.com.